Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. An hour about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking the future of podcasting. Here's a recent clip of a podcast put together by The Washington Post.
But the big question is, what are they actually doing with it all? It can't just be about building some massive digital library, right?
Right. It all comes down to creating that personalized experience you get on their platforms. You know, like those ads that pop up and you're like, wait, how did they know I was just thinking about that?
Oh, tell me about it. Like the other day, I swear, I Googled best hiking boots and then boom, Facebook showing me ads for hiking boots. I thought I was going crazy.
Nah.
So they are talking about a real issue. They're talking about Meta's terms of service, and it's a podcast explaining those rules and what they're really taking from you. But here's the catch. Those voices you just heard, they're not real people. They're generated by artificial intelligence, courtesy of Google and an experimental feature called Notebook LM. Washington Post tech columnist Jeffrey Fowler created the podcast to test this latest technology, and he's here to tell us all about it. Welcome back to All Sides, Jeffrey.
Hey, it's the real me, but is this the real Anna?
It is. So, you know, I, like many other people, don't have time to read everything that I'd like to. My TBR list is a little frightening. So now all I have to do is upload what I want to learn to Notebook LM, and it will create a podcast for me, right? That's what this does.
Yeah, this is sort of unexpectedly, I think, to folks here in Silicon Valley, Google's first real big AI hit organically. You know, all of the listeners know that over the last 2 years, we've been hearing about all these different new AI technologies, chatbots, and you name it. And the tech giants have been sort of struggling to figure out what to do with them, like how to make them useful to people. So Google had this little side project, actually, that they had a well-known science journalist named Stephen Johnson helping them lead. It was just a side project called Notebook LM. And Notebook LM was supposed to be a way to just gather all of your notes, recordings, clips, book snippets, you name it, into one place and organize them for you. And then they realized, hey, what if we just ask the AI to make a little podcast about all the stuff you upload? And they released that and people went wild. People have been uploading all kinds of things to turn into podcasts. I have heard from so many Washington Post readers about this. Some people I heard from, religious leaders who are uploading their sermons to hear about another take on what they have to say. I have been uploading, I'll just admit it, like books and those New Yorker articles you never quite have time to finish and turning them into podcasts I listen to during my commute. So it's really captured people's imaginations as a way to use AI that can benefit the user.
Yeah, I saw another article. I've seen two different articles. One where this guy uploaded his Tai Chi blog posts and got short podcasts about it. Another where a medical student uploaded all the text he needed to learn about kidney function. And it taught him in a podcast about kidney function. And he was really surprised at the accuracy of the information he was getting. And I'm sure we all know medical students, law students, they got a ton of reading to do. And it's really dense material.
Okay, that last example, though, makes me a little bit nervous because, you know, with any new AI technology, we sort of have these phases we need to go through. First, there's this moment of like, whoa.
Look what this can do.
Look what this can do. This is crazy. This is amazing. And then you need to, if we're going to be responsible about it, we need to really understand and admit what the limitations of the technology are. So we need to admit what the limitations of Notebook LM are. And as part of this, Sue, earlier you played that podcast I made about the Facebook privacy policy. Well, it did a great job, mostly, describing the Facebook privacy policy. But then as I took a closer look, as I stopped sort of being distracted by how real and human those podcasts sort of sounded, I realized they were choosing some strange things to emphasize about it. They weren't necessarily pulling out what an expert, someone like, let's say me, who's written like, you know, a decade of stories about the Facebook privacy policy, would actually highlight in it. And in fact, I even made a podcast version of my column in the Washington Post about Notebook LM. And when I listened to it, I noticed it completely made up some facts about Notebook LM. So we know that this is a known problem with the current generation of generative AI. It sometimes makes things up. It's really bad at math. And so I would not recommend using this for anything where it really matters. So that's why when you said a doctor was learning about kidney function, my heart skipped a beat.
Yeah,
for
it was
a
medical
was like,
student
uh-oh.
Experimenting. And yeah, this is a very key point, and that does come up in those too, is that it does a really good job, but all AI hallucinates. That's the word for making stuff up that doesn't exist. And it is definitely possible that these can hallucinate, but I mean, I think there's a lot of potentiality here, and it is unsettling how real they sound. They were bantering. He's like, I searched for boots, and now I'm getting all these ads for boots. This is a real human experience. Anyone who's been stalked online by an ad for something they considered buying knows this. And I was like, dang, that sounds like a real human.
Yeah, I think what you've hit on, there's this interesting moment that's happening right now in AI technology. And a lot of the capabilities that we have, so everybody knows about chatbots where you type things in, but over the last, I would say, 2 to 3 months, the technologies that we have access to as consumers have really pushed into voice, and not just like, you know, like Alexa robot voices. Sorry if I set off everybody's computers at home, just then. But really realistic human sounding voices where you can have a conversation. There's low kind of latency between when, you know, you speak and it speaks. And that has really like captured people's imaginations. So for example, and people are doing all kinds of interesting things with that. About a month ago, Meta, the company that owns Facebook, came out with a voice for its chatbot, but they paid celebrities to be those voices. So you can go in and use the Meta chatbot to have a conversation with Judi Dench or Awkwafina or a number of other celebrities. So they're really trying hard. And I think one of the goals with the companies with this is to make people more comfortable using AI. And certainly, you know, these voices and being able to kind of pick up on some of the very human ways of talking. I mean, one of the things that the creators of Notebook LM told me is they spent a lot of energy thinking about those little moments in the conversation where there's little pauses, you know, people say nice things to each other. If you listen to enough of these podcasts, they even added in like, we'll be back right after this break kind of moments to make it feel like a podcast. Which is pretty impressive because otherwise nobody in reality wants to listen to two computers talking to each other. That is in fact really boring. AIs are not actually that interesting, but they can now simulate how it might be if humans were actually having that conversation. And it's remarkable.
Yeah, the hosts had a decent structure to their podcast about Facebook terms. Like, not whether the content was accurate, but from a storytelling technique, I was impressed in the sense that they acknowledged that these terms of service are boring. They said it was important. Then they gave us examples that might be eye-opening or, you know, they're tracking your mouse clicks, how long you pause on areas. And I'm like, yeah, that is creepy. Is that in the terms of service? Like, they did the engaging hook opening for a podcast. And I was like, oh, crap, that is better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I was really surprised that kind of by default, that podcast took the point of view of the user, right? Like, most people are pretty creeped out by what Facebook does with your data, a thing I have discussed on this very show before. And you know, I did not give it a prompt. I literally just uploaded the text of the 99-page Facebook privacy policy and asked it to make something. So a little bit of that is a product of the origins of Notebook LM, right? So it was made as this tool for researchers, this tool for, frankly, journalists. And so some of that was kind of embedded into the AI's values about what it looks for in a set of documents and how it decides to kind of question them.
Yeah, I've also, Microsoft Word has now an AI feature that'll read you a Word document. That voice, I've noticed just in the last couple of months, has gotten a lot better as somebody who has it read documents. There's a bunch of apps where you can take a article off the web, put it into the app. It'll read it to you. It has different like voices you can choose from. I mean, the Washington Post, the New York Times have the like read me the article. Those sound more robotic, but they're getting there.
Yeah, let me tell you about another experiment that I've been working on recently. So now that all of these big AI companies have voice versions that are supposed to be able to engage in conversation, I've actually taken two different phones. I've set them down, put them in a room, started it. They both say hello to each other and just let them go and have a conversation with each other for hours and hours and hours and on end, just to see where they would take each other, how they engage with each other. And it also, it's pretty revealing of where the weaknesses are in this current technology as well. For example, one of the things that they cannot figure out how to do is how to end a conversation. Like I've seen them
they're trapped in conversations that won't end.
They're for 20 minutes. They'll go around in circles saying goodbye to each other. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. but that's the moment we're at, right? Where we can have two different AIs pretending to be humans, or even pretending to be celebrities. Scarlett Johansson talking to Judi Dench, going at it for a while.
You've also asked readers to email you how they're using this feature. We heard some of that. And you referenced the podcast Histories of Mysteries, whose creator is researching topics using ChatGPT and then using Notebook LM to generate this audio. It's very AI-based.
Absolutely, yeah. People are doing all kinds of creative things. Making true crime podcasts. I've heard of people that are uploading the contents of their unread tabs on their browser so that they can get a summary of the things that they meant to read during the day.
That's a good idea.
I know some journalists, I won't name any, who have to host shows where they interview the authors of books that they probably don't totally get time to finish reading, uploading the PDFs of those whole books so that they can get a sense of them.
That is something.
Yeah, so a lot of really creative uses. But, you know, one thing that really struck me in thinking about this, so right as Google came out with this for the public, there was an article in The Atlantic magazine that basically said there's a problem at universities, even elite universities right now, that students are unable to finish reading a book.
Yeah,
something
I've seen
about this. Yeah, something about the way that they've been raised with smartphones and all the distractions.
And
that,
teaching that professors, to tests.
And teaching to tests. And the professors are not even bothering to try to assign the whole book anymore. It's just like a chapter here or a chapter there. And I thought about myself, if I made myself a college student today and I heard about this kind of technology, I also might want to just load up my reading assignment into Notebook LM and listen to it. And I would be very tempted by that. But the question is, would you learn the same way using the AI as you would if you just read the whole thing yourself? Like, what does it do? I mean, 20 years ago, we started worrying, is Google making us dumb? And I wonder as well, when we have AI do the listening and reading for us, what is it doing to what we actually learn and retain and the connections our brain makes? And I think these are real questions to ask.
Yeah, we have another clip from that Histories of Mysteries. It's episode 8 about the ghost ship Mary Celeste.
All right, get this. Picture yourself sailing the Atlantic, December 1872.
Oh, spooky. Setting the scene already.
Right. You see a ship, the Mary Celeste, just cruising along, but something's off. No one's at the helm.
No captain.
Nope. But there's a half-eaten meal on the table. It sounds like a ghost story, right?
Almost. Except this ghost ship is a real historical mystery. Over 150 years later, and people are still trying to figure out what happened on the Mary Celeste.
I mean, accuracy or not, it is entertaining.
Yeah, they really nailed that part of it. Now, what comes next for Google is to figure out how to kind of allow the user of the technology to have more control over that conversation. So both in terms of its content. Again, today, the way this Notebook LM works is you just upload documents and say, make me a podcast. But in the future, maybe you could ask it to address certain questions or tell me more about that ship and why we should be curious about it.
Set the parameters also, for the podcast.
Exactly. Or even the nature of the podcast voices, Do you want two people? Do you want
Two
a
women,
man and a
two
woman?
men,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly. Now, and I want to say, you folks listening to this might think like, well, this is the end of NPR, or this is the end of professional journalists like Jeff and Anna. And you know what? I don't think so. And let me say why. There is no actual replacement for two real humans having a conversation right now. No actual replacement for a journalist who actually can, edit in and focus in on the right ideas. The market that I think this fills is the very, 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 very large untapped market of things that nobody would ever make a podcast about, right? No professional would have time or interest, and there would not be a large enough market to do a podcast, just about the tabs in your web browser. So it's using the power of voice and the sort of mimicking the humanity of it to bring that to the user in a new way, and that's really powerful. But that is not actually a replacement for journalists.
Yeah, and also, all the academic articles, all the things that Notebook LM uses is information and documents created by humans. So it is reliant upon that to build that podcast, at least right now, right? If we put in all your articles about Meta and say its rules, those are all things that were generated by people.
Yes, for now. But
For now.
unfortunately, the internet is quickly being filled up with AI-generated slop. And now the AI-generated slop is feeding back into the AI. And there's plenty of folks who are worried that we're headed towards some kind of, terrifying mirror world where we don't know what's real, what's not anymore, because there's so much bad stuff out there.
Yeah, I will say the one thing that gets super creepy for me, you referenced that Meta will let you have conversations with famous people. And I know it's getting really good at mimicking voices for which it has a lot of audio. So I've been in this job for almost a year now, which means you got a lot of audio of my voice. And I wondered if you uploaded all of my shows, gave AI a topic, if you could get an all sides that sounds like me.
You absolutely could. In fact, Anna, I wouldn't even need all of that audio clip of your voice. I would need about a minute of it to be able to do a pretty good version of your voice. And I know this because there was an event that the Post hosted about a year ago, and we invited Senate Majority Speaker Chuck Schumer, who's responsible for crafting America's laws about AI, and with his permission, I took about a minute of him speaking, audio clip of it, uploaded it to a commercially publicly available AI, made a version of his voice endorse Spider-Man for president, and then do it in Spanish as well. And he was like, "Good grief, that sounds like me." That's where we're at. Here we are in 2024.
That was Jeffrey Fowler, tech columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Coming up, documents allege TikTok knows a lot more than it claims about the addictiveness of its app. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Stay up to date even when you're out of town. Take Ohio's best radio news with you. Listen to 89.7 NPR News through the WOSU Public Media mobile app.
At NPR, it's our job to be skeptical.
So tell me, why is this not already happening?
And provide context to the day's headlines.
Where does this leave U.S. efforts to try to broker a ceasefire to end the war? Where does it stand?
This is independent reporting you can trust. This is NPR.
Listen every day on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our second topic is TikTok. Newly released documents show the company knows more than it's let on publicly about the harmful and addictive qualities of its app. Confidential communication by the company shows kids who scroll through 260 videos can start forming a habit, and you can get through all those videos in as little as 35 minutes. That's just one of the details from a lawsuit filed last week by 14 attorneys general. NPR and Kentucky Public Radio broke this story, and NPR technology correspondent Bobby Allen joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Bobby.
Thanks for having me.
So these revelations came from court documents, and I don't know that it's surprising, but it's surprising to see it in black and white, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people suspected that TikTok executives knew quite a bit about just how harmful the platform can be, especially for the youngest users, for teenagers. But these documents just really laid it bare. I mean, really showed that upper management knows very acutely just how impactful TikTok can be and just how harmful TikTok can be when it comes to the mental health of young people, when it comes to social comparison, like comparing yourself to other people on the platform, when it comes to just how addictive TikTok can be, and all of the other effects that that compulsive use can have on a teenager's life. I mean, these documents really underscored that executives knew about it and they just decided not to fix it.
The lawsuit is part of a 2-year investigation that alleges TikTok, with its 170 million U.S. users, was pretty much designed with the intention of addicting people to the app, right?
Yeah, that's the allegation in the lawsuit. And the reason why it is focusing on the design is because there's something called Section 230, and it's a federal protection that is basically a liability shield for the entire tech industry. And it makes it really difficult to sue a technology company like TikTok. It basically says anything that is hosted on a social media platform, the tech company is not responsible for that, right? So these attorneys general are being kind of clever and saying, okay, fine, we know the tech industry has this big legal shield. Let's go around that by looking at TikTok as a product that is defective. So they say the design of TikTok is defective. It intentionally is harming teenagers, and they're putting a spotlight on the algorithm. And they're also saying you, TikTok, violated consumer protection laws because you knew about the harms of the platform and you lied and misled the public, and that is against consumer protection laws. So these attorneys general are suing and asking for fines that would be used to compensate consumers, and also for platform changes to change the design of the app.
It really gets at the heart of TikTok's algorithm, which is something we've talked about more than once on this Tech Hour, because that algorithm is the heart of TikTok. It's what makes it so valuable as a company, and it's also what makes it sometimes feel like the app knows you better than you know yourself.
Yeah, the TikTok algorithm is something that has been an obsession in Silicon Valley, Meta and YouTube and Snapchat, and every tech company you can name has tried to emulate it, and it's just impossible. There's a certain kind of secret sauce inside the black box that is the TikTok algorithm. And these documents that we got our hands on have shown, as you mentioned at the top, that not only is it engaging and powerful, but potentially addicting, right? After 35 minutes, as you mentioned, right, on this app, teenagers are forming a habit. They're becoming hooked. There's something about how hyper-personalized it is, just how much of a dopamine hit it gives teens every time they're using it, that it just becomes a part of their life in a way that they can't let go of. And, there's one attorney general who compared TikTok to digital nicotine. I mean, they're really viewing this as the latest type of teenage addiction.
Let's talk about how you got the pages in question. So the documents were supposed to be redacted, but Kentucky Public Radio reporter Sylvia Goodman figured out how to read the redacted portions. How did she do that?
Yeah, so these lawsuits, there's 14 of them filed in 14 different states, and the really juicy bits, so the stuff that came after 2 years of subpoenas and depositions and other investigative efforts, huge, huge amount of evidence, the really juicy stuff was redacted, right? And that's because the lawsuit was given to TikTok before it was filed, and TikTok had an opportunity to say, okay, yeah, this stuff is confidential. This stuff could be embarrassing. Let's not put this in the lawsuit. We're going to, you know, save that stuff until trial when we have no choice but to address it. But in Kentucky, whoever did the redactions, you know, did it in a way where you can literally just copy and paste into a separate document and all of the material that was blacked out can be revealed. This was a complete and utter clerical error. And as you said, Sylvia Goodman at Kentucky Public Radio figured this out. She and I went through 40 plus pages of redactions, put it into a Google document, and just analyzed it, just went over it with a fine tooth comb. And yeah, the evidence here is really breathtaking. I was really taken aback by a number of the admissions in the form of communications between executives, internal presentations, and other meeting notes that really show just how much TikTok knew about the harms of the platform. It's really startling stuff.
Yeah, one of the headline-grabbing parts of this was it confirmed what many users already suspected, that TikTok's algorithm promotes users that it deems attractive, and the role that beauty filters, those like slight touch-ups to actually sometimes pretty dramatic alterations of your face, can help people get their content out to more viewers.
Yeah, and this is, I think people somewhat cynically thought, it seems like so much of my TikTok feed is full of extremely attractive people. Maybe that they're just the influencers who are successful. No, these documents reveal that there is something about the TikTok design that is algorithmically boosting people who are deemed more attractive by the company. And this came out in a series of documents in which a company staffer said, hey, it seems like quote unquote unattractive people are filling up the FYP, that's the For You page, the main feed on TikTok. And so adjustments were made so that the more attractive, as TikTok sees it, users were amplified and highlighted on the platform. And, you know, experts looked at this and said it is only feeding directly into the ways in which young people are using the platform, putting it down, and then ending up feeling pretty bad about their image, about themselves, and feeling like they have no choice but to compete with these people who look like models on Instagram and using beauty filters and using all of these, you know, enhancements to artificially change the way they look. I mean, it's really disturbing, just the ways in which this can change the way you see yourself using TikTok every day.
Yeah, there's a lot of different, there's hundreds of beauty filters on TikTok. Some of them are really subtle, so it's hard to tell. Some of them are very obvious, but they all slightly alter yourself in a way that I think sometimes, particularly for younger women, you start to see yourself the way you're presenting yourself on TikTok, and then you're increasingly less satisfied with what you see in the mirror.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've done reporting before that has looked at a phenomenon where plastic surgeons are even saying in cities like Los Angeles that clients are coming in and showing them a TikTok filter and saying, I want my real face to resemble what this filter did to it. So it's literally forcing some people to try to make permanent changes to their appearance so that they would look like this sort of AI enhanced version of themselves. So it's not just emotional effects. Some people are taking this to the next level and trying to find inspiration in the TikTok beauty filters and change their real physical appearance too.
Another thing in the documentation was TikTok has a time limit tool that is supposed to give kids a nudge that, you know, maybe you've been on the app too long. We're seeing this from a lot of social media companies. After a certain period of time, it says, hey, maybe you should take a break. But the document showed that TikTok's real goal in unveiling this was to improve trust and positive media coverage, which it just feels craven to see it that in black and white.
It really does. I think a lot of cynics of social media platforms like TikTok, when they see announcements that are aimed at improving safety on a platform, think this, right?
They, yeah, you know, you often might hear from critics. Think it.
Oh, Yeah, you might think this. Oh, this is just a superficial sort of change. It's just to get a positive headline. It's not actually gonna change the fundamentals. But to see it in writing that they literally are pushing this product feature as a way to try to boost their image in the world and generate some positive press coverage really does put it in some quite stark terms. I mean, the feature was meant to nudge people away from their apps to say, hey, you've been on this app for 60 minutes. Maybe it's time to do something else. And their own research showed that when they tested the tool, it only led to a drop in usage of about 1 minute. And they still pushed it anyway and made some false statements about how it was going to lead to a huge decline. Oh, TikTok is just this company that's willing to lose money and lose growth as a way, you know, as long as teens are using the app less and improving their mental health. Well, now we know that's just not true. That's just not true. And we can say it's not true by pointing to a specific quote from a company executive in these documents.
What has TikTok said in response since the records have come out?
TikTok is saying that these documents are outdated, that they are cherry-picked, that they're out of context. They're definitely in a defensive mode and really trying to say that their commitment to teen safety is being misrepresented, okay? And in response to that, I say, okay, fine. Well, if you think the summaries of the communication that we have, the summaries of the internal research we have is indeed cherry-picked and misrepresented, well, the ball's in your court, TikTok. Release the underlying documents, right? If you might remember the Facebook files, those revelations that came out after whistleblower Frances Haugen leaked them to the press, it's very similar. The conclusions in those files and the conclusions in the files that we obtained are very similar, but the difference is in the Facebook files, all of the underlying materials were released. Here we just have summaries. So look, TikTok, if you really think it's cherry-picked and misleading, release all the documents and the public can make their own assessments.
Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut and Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee have called for all of the documents. They're the ones that are pushing that Kids Online Safety Act that is stalled in the House. So they're asking to see all of it to have a better understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah, and that was a pretty interesting development when that letter came out because, you know, as we know, members of Congress have subpoena power. So if there's an official letter asking for documents, that's the first step. But if TikTok balks or doesn't comply, they could be subpoenaed. I mean, they even, you know, they could maybe they're going to call the CEO, Shoshi Chu, of TikTok back to Congress to testify about these documents. We don't know, but from the Congress people who have reviewed them, there is a lot of anger. I mean, TikTok is already under the microscope over its ties to China and the possibility that it's a national security concern. I think all of social media right now is being scrutinized by lawmakers and the public, especially when it comes to studying the connection between social media and the adolescent mental health crisis that the country is dealing with. So into that really pressurized environment come these documents. And yeah, now we have two sitting senators who are saying, you ought to release them. So we're going to see where that goes. But, you know, as a journalist and someone who wants to see as much public information released as possible, I'm rooting for the disclosure, right? I mean, I can't say one way or another what Congress is going to do. And I obviously don't have an opinion on their particular perspective. But when it comes to the disclosure of the documents, yes, I want to see all of the underlying documents revealed because I think the public has a right to know this. This platform is being used by half of America. And if it really is having ill effects on millions of teens, we need to know exactly how and exactly why and what executives knew and when.
Yeah, some of the other documents, like there's so much. I highly encourage our listeners to go and seek out additional coverage on this because there's so many different, I still have so many different points that were in these documents that people are going to want to know about and think about everything from filter bubbles, which we all kind of know, right? The intrinsically, you see, it feeds you more of what you want. So it can lead to political polarization, or sometimes in the very worst cases, it'll feed you more harmful content, more content about self-harm or diets that lead towards eating disorders. And the app is just literally giving more of what it thinks you want.
Yep. Yep. No, absolutely. I mean, the filter bubble point is, you know, it's kind of an iteration on something people have been talking about for a very long time about the internet in general. This idea that you fall down a rabbit hole, that you end up being stuck in this sort of bubble, and it ends up just kind of reinforcing your pre-existing notions or opinions on any given topic. But when it comes to something like you know, your image of yourself, right, going into a filter bubble there could end up being very harmful. I mean, we saw a lot of instances that came out in these documents about people being stuck in filter bubbles that led to eating disorders, that were really pushing content that made them feel overweight, right, or made them feel ugly, or made them feel somehow deficient, right? And that's the kind of filter bubble that really, really can have an ill effect on a young person's view of themselves and lead to some really scary and alarming outcomes.
That was Bobby Allen, a technology correspondent for NPR. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're talking about Meta's Quest 3S, Advent calendars, and more. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Dungeons & Dragons may be 50 years old, but the cultural phenomenon keeps reinventing itself and luring in new players. It's been a big year of change for the game, and there's a new rule book. Russell Hawley, managing editor for commerce for CNET, got his hands on an early copy of the Dungeons & Dragons 2024 guide update and has wrote an article about it. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So the 2024 Dungeon Master Guide will be released on November 12th. You can pre-order it now, but you've read the whole book twice, I understand.
It's true. Yeah, I've had it for about 2 weeks now. It's been a little over 10 years since the last time the Dungeons & Dragons team made any big changes to the way that the rules of the game works. And this is something that happens every once in a while, but the big focus for this update was making it easier for people who had never played this game before to pick up the books and start playing in a way that just embraces the new audience that is available right now. If you take a look at, you know, any form of entertainment, be it television, movie, video game, there is some connection in pop culture right now to Dungeons and Dragons. And that means that there's just a ton of people who had never engaged with this before that are trying to play. And so a big part of this book is making sure that it is formatted in such a way that the very beginning of the book is, how do I even get started?
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny to me that you think that's not such an easy answer, or it hasn't previously been such a simple answer. How do you get started? What's the role of the master of the game? What are the roles of the players of the game? How do you create the quests? Like, it sounds like the first half of the book, at least, is an FAQ for setting up your very first game with your very first group of players.
That's exactly right. And this is something that, you know, I spent a bunch of time talking to the folks who helped, you know, kind of implement all of these new changes. And a lot of it came down to talking to so many different people who are now massive parts of this ecosystem. There are now, you know, 4 to 6 hour long Twitch streams once a week, at least, that are people playing this game in really elaborate backgrounds. And there are entire companies that have been built on just making what are essentially TV shows out of playing this game. And so working with those people to help influence, you know, what kind of advice you give new people, because that's like the number one question that almost any, you know, popular player of this game is you know, how do I get started? And if you listen to a lot of the answers that have been recorded, very few of them are, you know, oh, just pick this up and follow the first couple of pages and you'll be good. It's often a long kind of winding explanation for how you get started, because this is a game that was for a very long time built for nerds like me who would very happily pick up a 400 page book and read it before doing anything with that information.
You know, what's funny is I've never played Dungeons and Dragons, but my FYP thinks I might like it because occasionally I get videos of these like super elaborate game tables, custom made, like, and you're like, oh my goodness. I'm like, that is quite an architectural masterpiece.
A lot of money goes into this particular industry, especially when it comes to, you know, kind of building spaces that feel like it's your own. There are some incredible stories of people who have played this game the exact same game with the exact same friends for a decade, and then they've finished up a campaign by like renting out space in a cave, where they, you know, they actually like spend a weekend camping there and playing this game. Like, there are some incredible stories of you know people who have dedicated an enormous amount of time to this. And now I'm just now learning that the next time I come to Ohio, I know what you and I are doing. So that's gonna be great.
It sounds like I need to read this book first.
That is very true.
But for those who are experts in the game, who've been playing for decades, what are they going to get out of the guide?
So a lot of what you're going to find is the stuff that was initially introduced in the player's handbook that was released about a month ago, that has just a lot more kind of guardrails attached to it. So how to help someone build a character for the first time, or how to build a more advanced version of that character, you know, and how to build, you know, more elaborate set pieces, you know, kind of worlds for people to play in. It is exactly as complicated as you want it to be and exactly as easy as you want it to be. So if you want to sit down with someone for a little while and, you know, kind of play for a couple hours and then have it be done, it's very easy to do so. If you want to build something that you know you're going to play for 5 years, you can spend weeks building that out before you tell a single person what you're doing with it, with the contents of this book alone.
Yeah, so it definitely sounds like if you're into fantasy and sci-fi and storytelling, it does sound like the game has some serious appeal.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that this is, you know, there's always kind of a little bit of concern when it comes to Dungeons and Dragons right now amongst that community, because it is very much a game that is owned by Hasbro through Wizards of the Coast, and so this kind of corporate overlord who has made some comments recently about how they might want to use AI in this, and how they could, you know, kind of use this artwork to make more money. This was very much something that I think is going to put a lot of folks who are concerned about that kind of thing at ease.
Well, let's talk about advent calendars, because Christmas decorations are already in my store. So why not talk about advent calendars that actually start December 1st? So you and the folks at CNET have reviewed a whole bunch of them, and they really run the gambit. There is an advent calendar for everyone in your life.
Truly, whether you are aware that you are counting down the days until Christmas Day, or you're just, this is just a tradition that you've gotten into where you get a silly advent calendar, or even just as a kind of a weird white elephant gift, there are so many different options. And there is kind of this queasy bit in my stomach about talking about holiday things before Halloween has happened. And I apologize to your audience for breaking this sacred covenant between us. But yeah, more and more, a lot of this stuff is just coming out super early. And so whether you are a fan of, you know, kind of finding just exactly the right thing to give as a gift, or you're, you know, kind of interested in the kind of collectibles that you do for yourself. For example, Lego does a whole bunch of, you know, kind of collectible pieces as part of their advent calendar every year that they only release as a part
of
their
advent calendar. That's gotta be pricey.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people get into this, and you can spend anywhere from, $10 up to $250 for some of these advent calendars. Some of them are just full of different kinds of cheese, which is very exciting in its own way. But the thing that we found when kind of taking a look at the advent calendars that are going to become available for this season, is you really need to buy them as quickly as possible. There are a lot of retailers that are making it very clear that some of these bigger and, you know, kind of more interesting advent calendars are going to sell out quite quickly, just because there are a finite number of them that can be made. But yeah, if you're interested in you know, kind of participating in the advent tradition, you may want to start looking like next week.
Yeah, we always get the like chocolate teddy bear ones for our girls. but those are very like basic advent calendars.
That's right.
I mean, they do get crazy. I have seen luxury makeup advent calendars that are $500, $600, $700. They'll have like high-end fragrances. There's like alcohol advent calendars. I've seen people assemble like book ones. So you get, I mean, that would really give me anxiety in terms of all the books that I now have to read on my TBR. But if you're really into books, you can get ones like 12 days of fantasy books.
That is exactly right. Yeah, there are so many different options. A friend of mine last year was really into a whiskey advent calendar that had come out. And you know, there's just so many different ways that you can engage with this. And they really can get quite absurdly pricey, depending on what it is you're looking at.
We've also got an update to the Meta Quest virtual reality headset. It is the 3S. So what is new about the 3S? What is maybe not so new? And if somebody is thinking about a virtual reality headset for a gift this Christmas, what should we know before we buy, other than this one is way less expensive than the Apple one?
Well, and that's kind of the point, right, is that we now live in a world where, you know, after years and years and years of talking about Apple's, you know, kind of mixed reality headset and what it was going to look like and what it was going to cost and how it was going to compete with the other products that are out there right now, instead of making, you know, another $4,000 VR headset to compete with what Apple has made, Meta took a step back and instead released a new updated VR headset that is less than $500. And it carries a lot of the same gaming experiences that you already have available if you have used a Meta Quest headset before. This has much longer battery life than some of its predecessors. The, you know, kind of hardware that goes in it is able to be used without connecting to a phone or, you know, a heavy computer or something like that. It really is, you know, kind of designed to be the portable VR experience that Meta has been working towards for quite some time. And that's the big argument that Meta is making as we move into the holiday season, is you could spend $4,000 on this VR headset, or you could buy 10 of the ones that we just made. And I think that that's going to be a really compelling argument as we get closer to holiday shopping.
Especially if you have a kid at home, perhaps like myself, who has been begging for one. And I'm like, there is no world in which I'm spending $3,000 on a headset for you. But I mean, $200, $300, that's getting close to the cost of a video gaming system. It's getting more into the realm of possibility.
That's been Meta's argument from the beginning, like it or not, is that, you know, this is an entertainment system. You know, it is essentially a PlayStation you can wear on your face. And there's certainly a lot of room for that. And there are a ton of educational things that you can also do with these headsets. They are used in schools for some really incredible exploration things. There are museums you can tour with these things. But the video games are where a lot of the bread and butter for this comes from. And that is exactly the argument that Meta is making this year. And in a year where Nintendo is not making a new console, Sony is, you know, has made a minor refresh to their console, Microsoft is not releasing a new Xbox, when you walk into an electronics store and you go to look for those gadgets, Meta is going to be the newest thing on the shelf for a lot of people.
Yeah, we've done shows before about how our prison system is using them for virtual classes, which was really fascinating. Like, you can get a certificate in mechanics without ever actually working on the real life cars. They do it all virtually, which I thought was wild and like a completely different way to think about some of these educational courses.
That's exactly right. And not just, you know, when it comes to education, it extends a little further beyond that when it comes to things like physical therapy. There are several physical therapists that end up using these headsets, you know, in a way as a distraction. But there's been a ton of evidence that suggests that when they're not staring down at the thing that they have to do as a repetitive action, then, you know, they actually get a lot more out of it. And they end up recovering much faster when they have that, you know, kind of walk away that they can use.
There's also exercises. I mean, years ago, we bought the like Ring Fit and it was an interesting experience to play the little video game, do the exercises. Like, you have to do the exercises to win the challenges and defeat the monsters. And it's interesting. It got the kids moving. It got me moving. But yeah, it's a strange, like, I'm getting my workout while playing a video game moment.
It reminded me immediately when I started running for fitness that there was an app called Zombies Run, and it was an audiobook that only would read to you what was happening next when your watch knew that you were running. And that was the whole deal, was that it was this story of zombies that were chasing you through this neighborhood, but it only would advance in the story if you were physically moving.
I'm going to have to try that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a little older now, but yeah, it's a lot of fun to do, and I think it's free on most platforms now.
Yeah, I sometimes listen to thrillers or mystery books while running because you sort of get that page turning effect and you're like, ah, gosh, I really want to know. I guess I'll keep going.
That is exactly right.
So you referenced before the Wizards of the Coast, right? That's the publisher of games, and they're also doing a massive update to their books, right? Or is that still related to Dungeons and Dragons?
So, you know, there is a massive collection of books that come along with Dungeons and Dragons. You've got the two that we were discussing earlier, but then there is just a huge library of these other books. And one of the things that I found when kind of reading through the existing stories is that they're not going to need to re-release every single one of those things in order to play nice with the rules that have been updated. They work really well. So folks like me who have these libraries of physical books that they've had for quite a while, you're not going to have to go out and, you know, kind of rebuy anything new or anything like that. There are some pretty minor changes that you would make when you go to kind of reference some of the stuff in those books. But yeah, for the most part, this is very clearly something that Wizards of the Coast has been preparing for quite some time to make it so that this transition is as smooth as possible.
I have to ask, just out of curiosity, his final question is, how many books are there about these games out there? How many words have been written?
I would not hazard to guess how many. I know that just in the room I'm sitting in right now, I have 19 that I can reach
for. Oh my goodness.
That's not all of the ones that are in the house. There are hundreds that are just about playing the game. And then there are fantasy writers like R.A. Salvatore and dozens of others that have made just entertaining stories that have nothing to do with playing the game, but are set in the world that these stories are played in, that are easily, you know, another, you know, 100 or so books. This is a massive, you know, kind of enterprise of physical media.
That was Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening right here on 89.7 NPR News.